In this episode, we wait out there with Dave McCoy from Seattle, Washington. Dave grew up in Oregon in a family of fly fishers. From both parents to grandparents to great uncles, fly fishing was not just family vacations, it was a way of life. After fishing the storied watersheds of his home state, Dave left home for Colorado, where he worked as a ski race coach. In need of a summer job, Dave put his knowledge of the river and rowing to use as a fly fishing guide. While guiding, Dave discovered photography as a way to share memories with clients and enhance their experience. In 1999, Dave moved to Seattle and started Emerald Waters Anglers, a guide service and fly shop committed to the principles of sustainability and inclusiveness that Dave carried with him from his initial experiences in Colorado. We discuss storytelling your day on the water through five thoughtful photographs and tactics for reading water and catching sea-run cutthroat from the beaches of the Puget Sound. Welcome to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shemchuk. At Wade Out There, we believe fly fishing is special, but not elite, and that anyone can become a great fly fisher if they are willing to go, learn, and teach. Join me as I talk with other fly fishermen and women about their unique journeys into fly fishing, the rivers they fish, and the tactics and philosophies they practice. For those who can never leave the river in their hearts, this podcast is dedicated to helping you make the memories that keep us all coming back to Wade Out There. Welcome, Dave. Thanks for being on the Wade Out There podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Jason.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you.
Shortening your name.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Fine. We're like old friends, man. This is perfect. When you podcast together, it's all good. Yeah.
Cool.
I'm excited to talk to you because I'm from the Seattle area as well. Grew up in the suburbs, but
where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bellevue, East Bellevue.
Okay. Yeah.
So close to Redmond, kind of on the other side by
north of
Bell Red Road.
Yeah.
Yeah. In that area, kind of, which is completely different now when I was there in the 80s, you know,
it's changed from when I moved here in 2000 or 99. So, yeah.
Yeah, I left home when 98 and went and joined the Air Force, and I haven't been back a ton. I mean, I go back, visit family and stuff, but my brother's still out there, and you know, I always look back, especially now that I'm doing the podcast and I've been able to talk to so many different people from different places and stuff, which is a huge gift. But I look back and think, man, I didn't really get after it out there. I didn't really take advantage or know, I guess, a lot about it. My father took me to Montana a lot for fly fishing and things like that. So it's always fun for me to talk to somebody like you because it brings back these memories of places. And when I go back, hopefully I can go with my brother still. And maybe if he's listening, he can glean some information as well. So it's exciting, man. I appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah. Well, have your brother reach out to me anytime, man.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you, So you moved to Washington in what year? 2000?
99, 2000. Yep.
So right when I was leaving-ish.
Yeah, we just missed each other.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your beginning in fly fishing and maybe kind of what kept you coming back in the beginning when things were, you know, tough for you, if you can go that far back?
I am happy to do that. I'm not positive that the answer or my explanation of that is going to necessarily be inspiring.
Fair.
You know, my father and mother and their respective parents all fly fished. All my great uncles fly fished. Most of the vacations that I took during the summer, fly fishing. Disneyland? Hell no. It was Gold Lake, Davis Lake, Crane Prairie, Wickiup, Umpqua River, Mackenzie, Deschutes. You know, it was, I mean, don't get me wrong. That's not a complaint. What lovely places to, you know, to be raised. Metolius a bunch.
Where were you at?
I was in Eugene.
Okay. Eugene, oh, Oregon. Eugene. Cool.
Yeah. So I was horribly fortunate. I mean, those watersheds are still revered today. And to say that 50 years ago, I was cutting my teeth fly fishing on them almost sounds fairy tale-ish to some degree. the to fast forward to now, I always wanted I've always wanted the cool job. Wherever I lived, whatever I did, I just always wanted to be cool. And there was a time in life where fly fishing just was not cool to me. I did everything I could just not be home on Saturday and Sunday mornings, so that when my dad got up at 3 to go winter steelheading, I was crashed out at a friend's house, not having to worry about telling him I'm not going. Because early I would just wake up on the front, you know, on the front bench seat of the pickup truck with it pissing rain, and
you'd be happy.
Blackout. Well, I wouldn't say happy, but I didn't have a
choice. But you'd be there. See, this is kind of making me a little bit depressed, Dave, because my son is 9, yeah, and he's probably on the bench of the truck right now like you are, going with me. And
well, I'll tell you,
I'm
don't
wondering,
give up on it.
Yeah.
It was force-fed to me for as long as it could until soccer kind of took over, and I was obligated to not go on those trips because I was playing soccer. But fast forward to getting the cool job, which was a ski race coaching job in Colorado, and needing a, you know, 3-month-a-year job between ski season. I'd grown up rowing boats. I'd grown up fly fishing. And a friend of mine that I was going to live with in Vail said, hey, Gorsuch has a guide school sort of recruiting camp coming up in a week. You should go do it. So paid $300, went over, took the, did the guide school, and yeah, there was it. Like, they hired me on the spot, and ever since, fly fishing I've somehow managed to keep as the cool job.
So now it's cool. Do you ever,
now I don't know if it's cool or not.
That's what I was going to say. Do you ever go back and forth now? Like, maybe it's not as cool as I used to think. Are you still loving it?
Well, I mean, I think that bleeds into probably some of the other questions that you want to ask later. I get about a 10-year itch typically on something. And if I'm not still intrigued and still captivated and engaged and feeling like I'm pushing the envelope, I get bored. I've got a little bit of ADHD in that regard. And
yeah,
I start to search for something else. Fortunately, I was, you know, I'm so deep into this now, there's no turning back. And so I just keep having to find ways to keep myself interested and engaged. And there's the loveliest part of this sport is the fact that it's deep in every direction. So pick a pathway and dive.
Yeah.
No, it's a rabbit hole in every direction. So
I was going to say, you picked a good genre of activity to be in if you have that type of personality, I would think.
For sure. Yeah,
there's all
I
the
think
different...
most people just have to give it a chance. And
yes.
Once they
well,
give
what
it
do you
chance,
mean by that?
Good question. I would say that a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people.
You can say a lot of people.
Yeah. How about there's people that will look at fly fishing as old white man sport and don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Pretentious, don't want anything to do with it. Any number of other things that
cost too much money.
Cost, yeah.
Only Rocky Mountains. If I don't live in
exactly.
the. Yeah.
I don't live in trout country, then why would I even bother? I don't have any trout around here. All I have are 10-pound smallmouth. Those can't be fun to fly fish for. So,
which is funny now that those are the places you're.
Yeah, that's right where I'm sprinting towards. Absolutely. I think the idea that so many people won't give it that first chance is a little bit of a bummer to me. And that's been sort of one of my trajectories since we opened the store, was figuring out ways to entice people to at least give it a shot. Like, even if it's just a simple 45-minute fly casting lesson, just to understand how fun the actual technique of fly casting is, regardless of the fishing part. I think most people, given the opportunity to give that a shot and being escorted into and through that initial engagement, can be a lifetime angler, fly angler. But it has to be, I also believe it has to be the right person that's introducing them to the sport.
Yes. One of the things we say at Wade Out There is fly fishing is special, but not elite. So everybody has this special experience, or not everybody, but if you know, your experience with fly fishing, my experience is unique to you. You have your own memories and your own friends and trips that you've been on. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to like, well, this is the way that it is. This is the only way to fly fish. I guess I just bring that up because I think a lot of times, myself included, you know, especially when I was in the Air Force, I had those preconceived ideas like, well, I'm not in Colorado, I'm not in Montana anymore. So I fly fishing is just not even, it's not possible in my brain, which sounds ridiculous for me to say that out loud, but yeah, it was not even a possibility. Like, what? I'm in Georgia. Why would I be fly fishing?
There's some good trout fishing in Georgia, though.
There's North Georgia. There's North Carolina. There's the coast. The Barrier Islands.
That's right.
There's stripers. There's bass. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. And I guess I just found that later in life and in fly fishing, kind of like what you're saying. A lot of people, or you didn't say a lot of people. You said some people.
People.
There's people. Yeah. It's so true. And I'm living proof of that.
Well, I think really
we all have that water around us. It's water.
I was just going to say that's exactly what I was just going to say, Jason, is I think our sport for the longest time and even to this day doesn't do the greatest job representing what opportunities exist out there. We're still overly enamored with trout or steelhead or tarpon. Or, you know, any of the pinnacle species that we've put up on a pedestal and bow to every time we get the chance. And what we've, and I think it's starting to change. And I have this conversation with the people that I work closely with in the sport. We need to be better about just presenting the idea that if you're near water, you can fly fish.
Yeah.
Period.
I think keep it
as simple as possible here.
I think that's true. What do you think about barriers to entry with regard to resources? Because I think that the internet is helping a lot of people connect with those waters in ways they might not have. But sometimes if there's not a fly shop, or maybe people just don't know or think to even look at a fly shop. I mean, how do you reach those people that are like, let's say, you know, like Missouri? Missouri is a good example. Mm-hmm. It's not really trout fishy waters you don't think of, but then if you go south, you have the Ozarks, there's great smallmouth fisheries, there's bass. And then there's just like bluegills and stuff that I went with my son to go mess around with. Do you think that, how important is that fly shop, or how do you reach people, or how, cause you're talking about giving them that message, right?
Is this a five chapter podcast? Like, is this,
it's not a trick question. I'll tell you, it's not a trick question. Okay. But I'm just saying, like,
it warrants a long-winded answer, though. That's the problem.
I'm good at interrupting, so okay. You go ahead and it'll be fine.
Well, first, I think, and I alluded to it earlier, I think not every person that represents the sport does so well. And there's going to be people out there that are really PO'd at me for saying it like that.
Are you talking about, like what you're saying before, like they're just not presenting
guides,
it, like
fly shops,
yeah,
companies, yeah, publications, like
in what way are they failing, I guess?
Man, that's
and again, we're not saying like all people.
No, I'm definitely not saying all people.
I mean, because a lot of people, especially the people I talk on the show, they're awesome, like super great stewards and welcoming, and like there's a
that's good.
A large
that's
amount of people. Yeah.
There are.
Yeah.
There are. I would tell you that number one, I hate the word influencer. I think it's the stupidest term that we've ever applied to this sport. And if anybody actually is sort of including themselves or labeling themselves as such and doesn't have the background to be considered, like if followers create an influencer, but you have the experience of which you might not be hireable at a guide service, then get out.
That's fair. Okay.
Because there's no possible way you could represent the sport in a way that, I mean, I shouldn't say that. I should not say that. Experience whether you like it or not, leads you to a place that you've tested the opportunities and the possibilities out there to understand what is going to work, what's not. And lacking some of that experience leads you to help people make bad decisions that might cost them their interest in the sport.
I think that's true. I think that there is definitely, it makes sense. I think there's definitely a temperament and a calmness that comes to a lot of people that have been in fly fishing for a long time that from experience that helps them kind of be that person that's going to introduce someone to fly fishing the right way. I also think that there are people that have experience that are still just not good folks to go on your first guided trip,
that was,
right?
That was just point A of what I was going to say about your question.
That's fair.
Point B would be that leave the ego behind. Yeah. If you're a fly shop or you're a guide or something of that caliber, please check your ego at the door when you're talking to new people of the sport. Be human, be approachable, be transparent, be forthcoming. Do not require money to be the key to getting the information vital to people finding early success in the sport, whatever that is, whether that's a location, whether that's a how-to, whether that's a fly, whether that's a little droplet of help with fly casting on the side of the shop or something before they take, you know, before they go out on their first adventure on their own. You just have to realize the sport is one of, you know, the foundation of it is about relationship, not just with you and the environment, but you and the other people that are co-enjoying it, co-participants. And by not being welcoming and instructive with every opportunity in a way that literally is soulful, it's wearing that experience or expertise on your shirt sleeve for people to glean from. You're going to get paid eventually if you're in this professionally. It's going to come. My God, like just settle down. You don't have to monetize every single word out of your mouth. And a lot of people try to, and I just kind of find that sad because it puts up a wall for a lot of people that try to reach out and get snubbed right off the bat by somebody who's like, well, I'd tell you that, but I need you to sign up for my class. I need you to sign up for my, you know, on Instagram, I need you to sign up for my channel. I need you to subscribe. Yeah. And it's like, really? God, okay. I get it. But like, can you just help?
Yeah.
Let me finish really quick.
Keep going. One
of the things that's really crazy about this is in the time when I was starting to get into it at that level you were talking about most of your listeners trying to get into the sport. I revered Flip Pallet so much. I wanted to talk to him so badly. No way it was going to happen. At least not as easily as it probably could now. But I wrote a letter. I wrote several letters. I wrote one to Sandy Moret. I wrote one to Fly Fisherman, and I wrote one to Fly Fishing and Saltwater Magazine. And in there, this is a term that a lot of youth these days probably aren't going to know what the heck it is, but it was a SASE, a self-addressed stamped envelope, so that my letter could be responded to without Flip having to write my address down, put a stamp on anything. All he had to do was just write a quick note, put it in an envelope, and send it back to me. You know, and it was so impossible to connect with the people that were really influential to me back then. It was just nearly impossible, other than happenstance of being in the right place at the right time when they were there. And today, with all of the technology and all the social platforms that we have, you can reach out to anybody right now. And the likelihood they're going to get back to you these days, pretty good, actually. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had, you know, I reached out to you in a similar way. And I had someone else on the show that had recommended that I talk to you, that you would be someone that might be interested in chatting. But it certainly is, in my experience, very much like what you're describing.
Yeah. And that's just so beneficial for our sport to have that accessibility that we didn't have 25, 30, 40 years ago. you know. So yeah. I don't understand why people would not be just checking their DMs every day just to make sure that there's not somebody that's on the precipice of getting into the sport asking just a simple question. And just by virtue of acknowledging the question and answering with something really short tips them over and they fall into the sport head first and then they're here forever. Like, that's just such a genuine, like, raw opportunity that we shouldn't be letting slip. And it doesn't have to be that magnanimous every time.
Right. Well, that's definitely one of the reasons why I started Wade Out There is that feeling that you're talking about, that feeling of going into a fly shop or talking to someone and just feeling like, I don't know if I feel welcome here or if what are the rules? I don't know what the rules are. Like, I want to learn. I'm here. I don't know where to go. Like, what am I supposed to do? Now I grew up kind of bumping around in Montana. So I had some situational awareness, some idea, but there was no fly shops on the Stillwater River in Absarokee, Montana.
The Stillwater. That's awesome, man.
You know, like, there's no river. Fly shops out there.
No.
When you're, even, and even if there was, I was.
But know that river's in Montana.
Yeah. There are no fly shops. And even if there were, when you're 15, you know, like.
Right.
And all you're doing is driving a tractor and in the rivers, like for after work. There wasn't that. And I guess when I went to Colorado and I was in school is when I first started seeing that. And so when I went back to start Wade Out There and I was thinking like, well, what was my experience? That became really important to me because of all the things that you just said, and I don't want to say them again, but I agree with you in a lot of ways. Why do you think, and I didn't think we're going to talk about this that much. So, but this is fascinating for me. So I'm going to keep going.
Stay with it, man. It's awesome.
Why I have my ideas on this, but why do you think it's so important for that person? Why is it important for that person to get that one DM replied to, or that message replied to, if that's going to be what tips them into the sport? Is it just because the sport is really cool? It's the cool thing. And I mean, what is it? Why is that important to you? You personally, I guess.
So I've got different layers of why that's important to me. I own a fly shop and I have people come in daily that are taking their second chance at the sport. Had a crap experience with this person or that place or whatever. May not even be a person or a place. It might have just been an experience. They just went out and got their ass handed to them by nature, you know?
Right.
And they're about to throw in the towel and they're again on that precipice of they're either in it or not.
That's a barrier. The barrier of just totally like not catching fish for days and like, what am I doing here? I'm going to stop. Right.
It's exactly. So, you know, barring the Mother Nature component, you know, if it was a bad experience with another human that could have made a different choice on how they engaged, I feel like as a shop owner and as somebody who represents brands, I feel like I have to go an extra mile to try to recoup as close to that first impression of the sport as possible when we get a second chance. And I'm more than happy to do it. Don't get me. I actually love doing it. I love showing them the empathetic, understanding, passionate, inquisitive, youthful side of the sport through somebody my age.
Yeah.
How I can still be a kid about it. Right. But I do not necessarily like the fact that I'm having to make up for somebody else who's considered professional in our sport, misstepping with that initial opportunity. If that makes sense.
That makes sense.
So yeah. The reason why it's important to me personally though, is I feel like being a father and so many other people out there being fathers and seeing the dramatic change in our fisheries and our environment, the planet's not growing new rivers. It's not spawning new watersheds. If anything, we're losing them daily to extraction and, you know, closure, privatization, water temperature, you know, whatever it is, we're not gaining watersheds. And so Not that having more people on the water is going to assist in that, but having more people understand that that's taking place is going to, in my opinion, help us take better care of them for the long term. And I just think fly fishing is also an awesome activity to engage with in the outdoors and can be an accoutrement to some of your other outdoor activities, whether it's climbing or mountain biking or kayaking or stand-up paddleboarding or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
it's just wide open. There's a lot of opportunity for you there.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it's a great way to spend time in the outdoors. Not just because you're in the outdoors, which is great, but it's the problem solving and the, you can go down the rabbit, it grows with you, you know, you can always kind of keep doing it. You're a perfect example of that. I think for me too, I think about, there's so many people I've talked to and it doesn't have to be like this for everybody. I get that, but you talk to some people and fly fishing has really become a part of their lives that is very, very important. In many cases, extremely important. And when I think about somebody else who might have the opportunity to have that activity in their lives that maybe can help them in ways that something else couldn't, the fact that maybe they don't get to have that opportunity because they had a bad first experience like you're talking about, that's discouraging to me. And then also, you know, especially for, you talked about being a father for my children, like I want my son and my daughter, I want them to have this in their hip pocket, right? Maybe there's a point in their lives when it's not cool and they want to go do the other thing, but at least
it's coming.
When I'm gone or they're off someplace else doing whatever they want to do, if they get to a place in their life where they need some help or they just want to, you know, they need to be, they need something, right? They need to level their, where they're at in life. They can kind of, well, maybe let me try that again. And my bet is that they will find, like I've found, and like I think you found, like that it is something that is there for you that helps you with those parts of your life that maybe need balance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I can't really explain how fly fishing fits into my life other than it's more my life fitting into fly fishing now.
Yeah.
It's just nearly everything I do, revolves around the sport one facet or another. And I don't know that I ever saw the path that I've walked coming. And I would say that as much as I try to dictate what my future, you know, what the path ahead of me looks like, I also enjoy looking at where it might go as a blank slate and welcome whatever, you know, direction it takes me with open arms, because it's a pretty fabulous place.
Yeah.
And it shows you the detail in our sport. When you start to really dive into it, whether it's the entomology or the knots or becoming a horribly proficient caster or reading water at a level that just I call it the matrix. You spend enough time staring at moving water. And I just see things and a lot of people in our sport just see things that are almost inexplicable to someone new in the sport. And that just helps me pay so much closer attention to everything else that goes on in my life. And I couldn't be more appreciative of fly fishing bringing that to me.
That's cool. Yeah. There's a lot of pattern recognition and a lot of, yeah, you can see things. Well, maybe I can't see things, but some people, I know what you're saying. I want to move on a little bit, Dave, and I want to talk to you about another aspect. You talked about the different parts of fly fishing and how you go down the different rabbit holes and how that's important to you and special for you. And I know one of those kind of complementary branches of fly fishing for you is photography, and has been for quite some time. And photography in fly fishing, beyond the grip and grin, right? And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that, but if you don't mind, I want to read something that you wrote first, if that's okay.
Okay, this ought to be interesting.
It has to do with fly fishing. Go for it. I think you're gonna like this one. Okay, it's gonna be all right.
Okay.
You wrote, and this is just to give people a background into how you came into fly fishing and why it's important to you, and hopefully you can expound on that for people. You wrote, I was told by a client 27 years ago while guiding the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, it sure would be nice if you toted a camera around. I can't capture all this beauty and enjoy fishing at the same time. I come here to fish, of course, that is the vehicle, but it would also be great if you knew some of the history, geology, flora, and fauna, threats to them here, because I want to know more about this place I love. Obviously, you can row, cast, tie knots, fish, and choose the correct bug, but that is not guiding in its entirety. Those are just the basics. I would love a holiday card of some capture I didn't know you had taken. It would make me look that much more forward to returning. Okay, that's the end of him talking, and then you continue to say, there was more to this conversation. It altered who I became as a guide, husband, father, son, business owner, and person. So when one of my images is chosen for the fly fishing journal, it always reminds me why I picked up a camera, and it always means more when it is an accoutrement to an important story written by a dear friend. I will forever be grateful for that conversation at that time with them. I sincerely hope everyone arrives at the realization our sport is drastically more than a grip and grin. So I think that's cool that you were able to have that experience, that somebody was that forthcoming with you. Most people just keep that information to themselves. I think it speaks to you as a person that they obviously felt comfortable sharing that with you. Like, you know, they knew you weren't going to be like, yeah, whatever, man, get out of my, but you're going to receive it in a way that is reflective. So I guess my question is, I've got a bunch of questions about that, but first, how did that conversation alter your life? More, because I would assume it did more than, you're talking about being a father and a person and business owner. So how did it alter the course of those types of things beyond just, I got into photography, you know, obviously that maybe, or maybe not obviously, but perhaps that spurred the photography, but it seems like it did more than that.
I mean, it took me a lot to write that, because it strikes really home in my heart.
We don't have to go down this road, dude. I didn't.
No, it's a good one to go down. I just have to sort of compose myself a little bit. I think you're right. I think that person, the unbelievable human that they were, saw something in front of them in me that was capable of deep impression, and seized the moment. Took an opportunity to see if they could affect what they felt should be a change in my life. I said earlier, I always wanted the cool job. Black Canyon's a pretty cool place. You don't just get to guide that because you know how to cast. You got to know how to row. My dad felt like rowing a boat for me was something that was going to enable him to fish more.
I'm going down these roads, man. I'm with you.
and so some of the trips that I've been on in the world where one of the single biggest components to me being asked on it was my ability to row. Every time I'm floating down those rivers and places that I would otherwise never see, I owe that to my father. That was just such a lovely, wonderful gift that he imparted to me, right? And so when you have a client that is looking at you as, you know, 30 years your senior and kind of reliving their youth, wishing maybe that they had been there to do that, and maybe they see that had someone taken that time to explain something to them would have maybe changed them too. Or maybe we were just close enough that that's a less of a client guide conversation and more of a you know, closer personal friend conversation, whatever it is, whatever it was, it landed heavy on me. And I don't know that I have a good explanation as to why, to be completely honest with you.
Was it obvious at that point where you think you saw like, yeah, there's more to this than having a cool job. And there's more to this than being the guy on the Gunnison. And maybe I'm not reaching my potential. Maybe there, you know, maybe there is more that I can offer the sport or my guests, or I don't know. I'm not trying to like,
no, I think
I'm just wondering like, cause if somebody said that to me, for that to hit home to me, it would have to be true, right? If somebody tells you something and it hits home, you might get upset about it, but, and I'm not saying you were upset about that particularly, but that kernel of truth is what gets to me. If somebody tells me, hey man, why don't you act different? Why don't you do this? And I've had those conversations too in the Air Force with instructors and my mentors and things. And when they tell me something like, dude, you need to try doing this. You know, if you want guys to listen and you want to teach people, they're usually right, you know?
Right.
So I don't know.
No, I mean, I don't know that I've ever delved into that a lot deeper than what I just, you know, wrote. I felt like writing it exposed enough of me that it would make people maybe question, shit, here we are. Jason, you're asking that question.
Yeah.
I just didn't ever expect it to come in form of like live conversation.
Yeah.
And I love it. I think I'm competitive. I've always been competitive. Played soccer my whole life, ski raced, played football, I played, I don't know how many sports. I'm just a competitive person. I drive competitively still. Like, just, it's in my DNA. So I think a little part of that conversation stuck more immediately as me looking over my shoulder at peers and saying, what would set me apart from who was, you know, who I was guiding with or against, or, you know, what that looked like in that field. And I'd have to probably say that was probably the initial one, but I think the other one was that I always held envy of some of my peers that were, you know, older than me and been doing it longer than me in that place, that did know things that, not that I didn't care about, but my attention was more on the fishing side of being in that location and not on, wow, well, you know, that cave up there, the Utes, you know, in the winter would use that as shelter when crossing through this Ute Canyon or the Ute Valley part of the canyon here. And yes, there is a path we can pull over and hike up there and check it out and see some of the, you know, faint remnants of their time spent there. And so then once I got past the competitive side, I started to get more into the compelling side. And I think that was for me, and that's why I said it, was very pivotal, because I started to realize that the sport, whether it was the rowing or the fishing or whatever it was that brought me to the Black Canyon, had put me in a really special space, and a space where I could affect the outcome of people's time with me. And that's something that I don't know before that point in time that I really gave a shit about. Pretty self-centered probably for the most part, until I had to sit down and really delve deep into that topic and realize that I did actually care about the experience people had when they were with me on the water. And the camera was a way for me to, at that point in time, express that to them by giving them visual memories of their time spent there.
Is that how it started for you with the camera and photography? Is like for your guests, it's like, hey, here's a snapshot of you fighting that fish or something, like, and where they maybe either were or were not aware that you're taking the photography, or just like you said, of the cave or the moment, kind of helping them remember that. Because again, a big part of Wade Out There is going back. And we talked about this before the show.
Yeah.
going back to the places that you have in your past, whether it's 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 2 days ago, like that, those places that are special to you, we all have the ability to go back. And, photography is a great way to do that. It's a great way to do that. And I think sometimes, myself included, I don't use that tool in the way that helps me go back to the max extent. I'm getting better at it because now I'm taking more trips with my kids and my father and my brother, and my father's getting up in age. So now it's more important for me to snap a picture of me and, or my brother and my father on the porch drinking a beer or whiskey in Montana than it is like, sure, hey, look at this big fish I caught. I will say, Dave, I do take fish pictures, and I've got pictures of me with fish, and
so do I.
If you research Wade Out There, most of the cover episodes are pictures of people with fish. So, so the Griffin Grin is out there, but I agree with you. And I do think that fly fishing is more than a Griffin Grin, for sure. It obviously is. I guess, can you talk a little bit first about the beginning of photography and how you kind of integrated that into your guiding? And cause that sounds fascinating. I think it's super cool. It's a great idea. And sounds like you enjoyed it as well.
Yeah. I think I was very fortunate in the people that I worked for early on in my guiding career had a very grounded 30,000 foot view, if that makes sense at all.
They did, or you did?
They did.
Okay.
And, you know, when you own a company and it's really small and it's a service-based company, every person that works for you needs to be as close to an extension of you as possible in order to continue to express, you know, why you started the company and what's important to the values of that company.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. You can't have somebody, it's like your brand, you know, it is. You can't have someone ruin that for you.
Yeah, no, it will, you know, prior to Instagram and Google ratings and stuff like that, you know, it still would put you in the ground if you had some bad press out there. Yeah. Word of mouth is still powerful, right? Right. So the people that I worked for early on were really understood that and were very critical of training the people that worked for them to understand that and to be representative of what the ethos of that company was. And that, you know, similarly to the conversation with my client in the canyon, landed with a lot of gravity. I started to respect what it was that I was doing more, started to understand what my position in that was. It was more team based as opposed to individual based. And that meant supporting my peers at the same time as operating my own trips, you know, day in and day out. And when it came to starting my own business, Washington is blessed with a lot of water, not necessarily blessed with the stereotypical Rocky Mountain trout water that everyone would sort of like to lay over the top of this place. Like,
yeah.
We're actually the antithesis of it in many ways.
I know. Unless you go east of the mountains. Yeah,
that's right. And even east of the mountains is not going to compare really. I know a lot of people out here really like to pump up several of our fisheries as just like the greatest thing in the world. And half of me is always going to tell people to wipe your slate clean when you show up to a fishery and take each fishery for exactly what it is in its own space. Yeah. Compare and the contrast is a really bad idea for new people to the sport. You just can't do that. They're different fisheries, and you should enjoy and appreciate each one of them for what they are. Right.
Sure.
And so with regards to the photography, I've been trying to get my staff out here to understand that we're not always going to be able to catch fish on our trips. It's just not going to always happen, whether it's steelhead, whether it's here on cutthroat, whether, you know, you've got a brand new person that's physically challenged and we're on a mountain stream and the trout eat the dry flies super fast and they're just not able to react quick enough to set the hook. So I always tell them you need to be able to take 5 photos during the day that represent the day from beginning to end and give a pulse on the experience that you just provided somebody. And you've got to think about it in light of there not being a fish involved in those five photos. And if you can still tell a compelling and endearing and memorable story in five photos and there's no fish on a fishing trip, you're hired. I'm hiring you now. And that was something that the people that I worked for early on impressed upon me constantly, is that it was, you couldn't control fishing, you couldn't control weather, you couldn't control 75 to 80% of the elements that were going to be involved in that experience, whether it was a day or a 3 day or a week long trip. What you could control was the story that you told and your food.
Well, food is funny. I've heard that before. Don't mess up the food.
Yeah, it's true. Don't mess up the food. Yeah.
That's beautiful, man. Honestly. I mean, that idea, that concept, that's something that if you can tell a story, if you have five photos, or let's say you're not even doing photography, right? But if you can tell a story about that day, and then you have that memory. And if you're thinking about that story, then you're forming it kind of as you go, or you're thinking, it's more about, it's like intentionality, right? I'm here to enjoy this experience versus catch the most fish, right? That's the grip and grin side. Like, whoa, wait, where's the giant fish? I want the picture of the big fish. Whoa, 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 man. Like, what about these other four pictures here? Like, these are important too, right?
What about this 200-year-old cedar over here that you were just standing next to?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I get it. Somebody asked me a question 20 years ago, 15 years ago, if you took all the fish away and you were just out on the water, would you still be there fly fishing? And ask yourself that. If you knew you weren't going to catch a fish, would you still be out there doing what you're doing?
Yeah. I haven't thought about that.
I mean, that kind of puts it in perspective, right? So the one element I would say that I can say yes to is spey casting. I think that's so fun in and of itself that I'd probably still be out there doing it because it's so dang fun. But the point I was trying to make was, it's like, it just isn't always essential to catch the fish. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about when you are the concierge to somebody coming into the sport, that early first impression is imprintable. It literally imprints on people, and it takes generations sometimes to get that, not necessarily wiped clean, but to counter it. And so if the first impression is we got to be up early, catch the first, the most, the biggest, stay out the longest, it might take 20 years to bring somebody back to the idea of, let's have a nice cup of coffee this morning. Let's watch the sunrise. Let's maybe get there when everybody else is gone and enjoy the place to ourselves. Maybe we come back and have lunch, and then maybe we go back, maybe we don't. Like, you know, just slow the pace just a little bit, you know?
Slow down. Can you talk about photography itself? Like, let's say somebody's listening to this and they're like, okay, yeah, I'm digging this concept. I want to start to embrace that a little bit more, and I can use photography. I have a cell phone with a camera, right? I can embrace that.
Sure.
What are some things that you think would help people that maybe don't have that artistic eye, or they're just not, I mean, not everybody's going to just become a photographer, or they don't have the interest in photography, but I still think anybody can kind of go down this road or have this concept of like telling a story about their experience fly fishing, especially when they go on a trip or something like that, or they're with friends and family. Now you're taking pictures of other people and you're giving them that gift. What are some things that you think about when you're trying to capture a day on the river or a day on the Puget Sound? And that's kind of a loaded question because it completely, totally depends. I understand that, but I don't know. Are there things you think about, or are there things you look for? Are there things that are typical kind of pictures that you see in these types of stories? And if the answer is no, that's fair. That's
a good question. No. So the answer will definitely not be no. In fact, it might be more detailed than you really wanted to have. But, and like the rest of my answers, it'll be long-winded and multi-tangented.
No, Dave, you're doing good. These are great answers. They're all welcome, good answers. So thank you.
So I guess if I, for a moment, just step back to how I like to guide. So I'm with somebody I've never been with on the water before, and we're going to either the Sound or the Creek or Steelhead River. First spot we're going to go to for me is a little bit of a above and beyond the window time we had to get there. A little bit of that first spot is a little bit of a, you get to know you, I get to know you, you get to know me situation. I get to watch you cast. I get to see how you receive, absorb, and implement information. I get to see your mobility. I get a little bit more robust picture of you in my head. So I know how to sculpt the rest of the day. Okay.
Yep.
And the thing that keeps me engaged in the guiding aspect is definitely stepping away from the result. At least the result is a fish. I want to see people leave a day with me a better angler, a more informed angler, a more engaged angler, somebody who's paying attention to more of the detail that is surrounding the fishery that they're choosing to engage in that day. And one of my favorite things, and it goes back to what, you know, that client told me, you know, however freaking long ago that was, I can see them starting to, it's like your kids starting to take their first steps. They start to walk away from you, right? Well, you start to see a client get the mending, the casting, the reading the water. And all of a sudden, I don't have to be in your ear going, mend, cast, mend, step, cast. No, here, step, high, lift your rod, strip. Yeah. I'm no longer required to be in your ear saying that. And now it's not that I'm not guiding you, but I'm shepherding you through this self-guided situation on a guide trip where now you're sort of taking this new quantity of information, this new bundle, and applying it to the water in front of you. And I get to watch. And for me, it's probably the most rewarding part of guiding ever, watching people do it on their own. Be like, done. This person's never, ever not going to do this again. Look at the fun they're having. And those are the moments that I get to step back and snap some photos that they don't know that I've taken because they're so engaged in what they're doing that they don't even know I'm not standing next to them anymore. And I love that facet of it. So to your question, how do you script the photos or how do I think about the five photos I'm going to take? I always want it to be representative of the location and the place and the time of year and the day. And that means taking into consideration, was it cloudy? Was it pissing rain? Was it hailing? Was it sunny? Did we have rainbows? Was the water clear? Did we just have, you know, the most obnoxious weather in the world? If so, then the photos that I'm going to take need to be representative of the stories they're going to tell their friends when they go back, right? So, for instance, on a rainy day, I might be taking, raindrops at the surface of the water level photos, just getting that little reverse wine glass that kind of comes up out of the water when a raindrop hits, or moss on a tree. In the fall, it might be, you know, a big, huge maple leaf laying in the water, or, you know, whatever. It needs to be something that's going to embellish their stories when they go home to tell them to friends and family. And that's how I'm thinking about what I'm going to shoot through the day.
I think that's cool. One of the things when I'm listening to you talk about that stands out to me is that it's not always, I mean, we talked about grip and grins, right? But it's not always even, it's easy, I think, for people and for me to, when I go fishing, I'm going to take a picture of the river. I'm going to take a picture of the mountain. And those are beautiful things and pictures, but when I'm hearing you talk, these are smaller things. These are the details that we don't think about a lot if we get in close, right? It's the, even if you're talking about a fish, maybe it's not a grip and grin. Maybe it's just, you know, the gill plate of a fish that you caught, or the tail, the spots or something that it was just really stands out to you, close up of a fish or, you know, something like that, or the rocks and rain. I think that's something cool that I certainly take away from what you just said, that those things, like, although they're not as big landscape type images, they bring back the memories just the same. You know what I mean? Especially if you know where they're from.
Yeah. And the big landscape images, there has to be one of those in there. You have to be able to, the macro only is powerful when you understand the scope in which you captured it in. Right. So if all you took were, you know, leaf and close up water and fish spot and mushroom and, you know, whatever photos, pine needles, whatever, but you didn't show the grander, you know, stadium in which these participants or these elements were present in, then you lose a little of that impact. You have to give the, you have to give people the full view as well.
I understand. Yeah, that makes sense.
So your five have to, in my opinion, have to represent, you know, that sliding scale of where we were and what happened.
I understand. And one of the five wouldn't have to be a fish, but if one of them was going to be a fish, how do you go about thinking about that?
That's a great question too. I think, you know, fish are, they're like snowflakes. There's no two identical, right? And so appreciating each one of those fish for what they are, and everybody's going to have their own affinity for one facet of them or another. Some people like on, you know, coastal cutthroat here in the Sound, when you've got one that's really colored up, for being in the river, in the freshwater for a while, that joint on the pectoral fin is usually like, you can't, I know you're not, this isn't a video podcast, but it's like the color of this cup where it meets the body, and it's just a spectacular color.
Bright yellow.
Other people, it's tails in the adipose fin. Other people, it's the slash on a cutthroat or the eyeball, the gill plate, you know, the close-up of scales of a tarpon, you know, whatever it is. Like, just think of whatever, when you land that fish, whatever it is that you're just wholly enamored with and would just stare at for forever, try to capture that the best you can. And it's not always going to be a perfect photo, but it's a representation of how it impacted you. And that's what's most important.
I think that's cool. I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, we talked about the importance of that conversation you had and with the fly shop that you've had and moving out to Washington. And now you have Emerald Waters Anglers, and it's a unique fishery. I know that you travel around a lot and you get to experience those different places and bring things back. What are some things that people, when they come to your fishery, when they come to the Puget Sound, let's say it's just narrow in on the Puget Sound, what are some things that they take away or that surprise them? Are there trends in that department? Are there things that when clients show up, maybe from out of state, that they're surprised by or intrigued by, or that they take away to their fisheries?
Intimidated by?
Maybe. Yeah, I'm going to get into that too. So now we're going to get into a little more of the tactics. I'm going to, like, so how we catching fish on the Puget Sound type questions. But because I selfishly want to know some of that stuff. But yeah, I'm curious what people find unique and, like, you know, technique-wise and fishery-wise, like when they come to visit, that maybe they take away.
No, that's a good question. I think we have if I looked at our entire business model, I would wager that half of our business, and in the summer, it's probably more than half. In the summer, it's probably 70% of our guide business are people visiting Seattle from out of state.
That's so crazy, right? That was me when I was a kid. Like, why was I not doing it? I mean, sorry, but that's just insane to me. It's right there.
Well, no, it was like that when I moved here. I moved here, all the shops in town told me it was either Steelhead or the Yakima. And if you had to, if it was necessary, you'd fish the Middle Fork of the Snoqualmie.
You know, in your backyard. I fished the Middle Fork of the Snoqualmie, right? When I was a kid. I didn't catch any fish.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it was all based on, you know, that result that I try to push back against. It was all about where the biggest fish were. And like, we just have so much more to offer here. And the sound is a huge component of that. The sound's pretty intimidating. It's huge. It's massive watershed. There's beaches that you'll be standing on. And it's 4 miles across to the nearest to the other shoreline. How insignificant do you feel when you step in there and make your best?
Yeah.
You know, because everybody casts 100 feet. You know, you make a 100-foot cast and it still feels puny. You're like,
right. How am I reading this water? This, you know, I'm looking at the Puget Sound.
And then there's that.
Like, what are we doing?
Exactly. Yeah. Then there's that too. And it's not caddis and mayflies and stoneflies. It's, you know, your different chum fry patterns, and it's euphausids and copepods and you know, a myriad of other food forms that are foreign to somebody that was raised fly fishing in fresh water. And I get it. I'm going to be the first to admit that that's new, but in the spirit of being human, challenge yourself. Dive in, get in there and learn something new. It will make you a better overall angler to not fall into the one human trait, which is habit, and just being, you know, driven by what's easy. Challenge yourself to learn and become adept at another fishery, because you're going to take away from that things that are going to help you on the watershed that you would otherwise go to. Whether with Puget Sound in particular, it's going to be reading water and casting. Because we'll have people come out from the Rockies and elsewhere that fancy themselves as pretty accomplished anglers. And it's not that they're not, but they're also in a boat 90% of the time casting 35 feet with, you know, a big indicator on there. And then you get them out into the sound with a 15-mile-an-hour headwind, and they can barely get a 25-foot cast out there. And it's like, well, here you go. Yeah, you got to learn how to cast. That's one of the core components of our sport. Fly casting proficiency. So
right, sure.
Buck up and get on it, you know.
It sounds like what I'm hearing you say is, if you're going to go fish the Puget Sound, step one is you got to, most people, you know, if you're new to it, right, you have to just kind of rip the Band-Aid off, and this isn't the same. So we're going to do, it's just a different animal. We're starting at, maybe not starting at zero, but we're going to, this is a new animal, and we're going to, like I said, rip the Band-Aid off. And you mentioned two things that I would deduce are kind of the two places I would go from that clean slate. And that is reading water. And what was the second thing you said? You said,
no, being a proficient caster.
Yeah. Okay. So casting and reading water. Can you talk a little bit about, some techniques that you have? Let's start with reading water. I mean, how do you go about breaking down a watershed like that? Or where do you even start? You know, I mean, I go with Dave, and Dave has been there a bunch. He knows. I mean, because even when you're fishing a river, which is much smaller, but you have places, you kind of know, you have ideas about, you have your honey holes, you have your spots, right? And I'm sure you have places that are better for you than others. And I'm not asking you for those. I'm just saying, how do you go about starting to learn to read water? Like, what are some things that you look at?
Well, like, I mean, that's a great way of asking it too, Jason. I think it's overwhelming if you try to just like wrap your arms around all of it all at once. So let's, you know, start simple. You know, in a river, you go and you're like, okay, I'm standing on which bank, left bank or right bank? And water's flowing from what direction, left or right? And is there any water moving? You know, it's kind of the same thing here. Like, the sound doesn't have that same sort of construct of a bank that gives you a very definitive flow direction. But because of the tides, you do get current flow along the beach, and it acts very much like at times a slower moving river. And so first things first is, okay, go to your, choose your beach, wherever that is, and sit up and just look at the water for a few minutes before you just throw your waders on, grab your rod and go jump into the water. Like, just watch the water for a minute. And from watching it, can you deduce what direction it's flowing, you know, versus the bank? Is it flowing from right to left, or is it flowing from left to right? And that's going to be hard to discern sometimes, because if you've got a breeze, the breeze is going to make it look like it's flowing one way. Mm-hmm. So you walk out, you make a cast of 20, 30 feet and see what direction your line moves. Okay, so now I know. All right, I'm moving this way. So in the sound, fishing bait fish, your fish are always going to swim facing that current, unlike most river situations. Unless you're tenkara or steelhead and spey casting, you're going to move down current in the sound. So you'd want to walk to the top of the beach or whatever you have access to and start there and walk and fish your way down that current. That way your cast and your fly are always coming across and up current as you retrieve it. And that's kind of first. Second is, I always tell people this, even if you're not going to fish, and wherever you happen to live in Western Washington that's close to the sound, find three beaches that are close to you that have different sort of directional orientation and have different substrate sort of geography or topography to them, so that it gives you a different look to the sound. And then you should see those beaches at the highest tide and the lowest tide and everything in between. And you should see them at three or four different times during the year, because seasonally you'll have kelp that's there, kelp beds that emerge and go away, that changes how the water flows on those beaches at different tides. And then as you start to go into it a little bit more and you start paying, you get to where you've got your head wrapped around it enough that you can start to take more information in and digest it and retain it. Okay, well, let's look at your tides. Are you fishing spring tides or neap tides? On spring tides and you've got water that's got significant push to it, that water is going to move differently at this part of the sound than a neap tide will, because with a neap tide where that beach is, you're going to have more of kind of a gentle lowering and dropping, and you're not going to quite get that tidal rip, because the pendulum swing of how that water changes as the tide changes is it doesn't stall the water, because the water clearly leaves, but it doesn't allow it to act like a river moving out. So it'll feel like it's, you know, you're at the tide change almost the whole day, even
more
though
stagnant,
either
more just in between. Yeah. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Totally. Yep. So you do, and go back to the question you asked earlier too, or what we talked about earlier too, that's where as a fly shop, you know, myself and our staff, we want to be as forthcoming as possible on this stuff with you. This isn't a pay-to-play bit of information. If us giving you the exact spot to go stand in and how to read that water and what, you know, walking you baby steps through this sort of progression is going to help you stay in the sport and stay fishing Puget Sound. My God, that's exactly what we're here to do.
Well, I can understand that perspective, certainly. And also because I'm putting myself on that beach, right? And listening to what you're saying and trying to think, like, because I know, and I've been there and I've stood on the beaches and been like, where are the fish? Like, I know there's tons of fish. And I mean, yeah, it's a giant, but how do I even go about starting to do this, you know? And even just the stuff that you said, you know, you don't think about these large bodies of water, even lakes and things like that, but especially currents and tides and things. There's a lot of movement going on. And also, you think that it's just flat, right? It's flat and static. But it's not. There's a whole underground kind of landscape that exists. What are some things that you think about with that kind of topography of underwater, and how do you even, I mean, I guess with tides, you can see some of that when the tide comes out, you can see what that kind of looks like. And so when the tides are different, you have a better idea, but are there things that you consider with underneath the water? I think the current is a great, great help, you know? What about that as far as fish and reading water and things like that?
Yeah. Well, that's why I tell people you need to see your favorite beaches at the lowest tide, because then you know what you're fishing over. Because, you know, there's going to be beaches that you catch fish on that have none of the structure that has been written that you need to look in order for a beach to be successful or be worthy, right? Jumbled rocks from head to fist size with a consistent pitch down into the water. Yes, that's ideal for sure. But are you always going to have that? And are fish always going to be there? No. The beaches that don't have that, if it's closest to you and that's what you've got an hour to go fish it. And the reason that all that structure gets talked about isn't necessarily what you would think is the same reason that it would be in a river, that it's creating a holding spot for fish so that they can, you know, relax and stuff like that. The cutthroat, by and large, current's rarely moving fast enough for them to just hold and have the water pass through their gills in that fashion. They're pretty much consistently just marauding around looking for food. So what the eelgrass and the kelp beds and the sand dollar beds and oyster beds and, you know, that, you know, multi-sized rock riverbank is going to give you is the shelter for the food forms that they're feeding on.
Mm, yeah.
So it's, they're in that kind of water because that's where the food that they're typically going to eat are. And that's kind of how you have to think about this.
And we're talking mostly, this would be sea run cutthroat, like you'd mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of salmon and steelhead and these types of things in the Puget Sound at different times of year and different runs, and there's different seasons and stuff. And that can become complex, I guess. But the sea run cutthroat are their home station, right?
They're there all year.
They're there all year. So you can always go fishing for these guys, and you don't, I mean, not to say that you shouldn't, but if you were just, I want to spend some time on the water, I want to cast, I want to work on my cast, I want to fish, I want to be out in nature, like we were talking about before, this is a way you can do that. It doesn't have to be steelhead, and it doesn't have to be salmon runs and things like that, which can also kind of become their own, depending on where you're going, I would imagine they can become their own kind of, I don't know if this is the right way to compare it, but like their own Madison River in July, where it's, you know what I mean? Like,
totally.
Hey man, there's a lot of boats out here. Hey, we all know where we're going and what's going on here. So to me, that's what I like about what you're describing in the Sea Run Cutthroat, is because it is like my brother lives out there. If he wanted to go fishing, he could do this, and it doesn't need to be, besides the tides, I guess. But I mean, you don't have to get into that other part of it, I guess, the salmon and stuff. But
well, let me add one thing really quick to what you were saying.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I would say that, even though I've put this onus on your casting proficiency, we catch most of our fish at 25, 30 feet.
That's crazy.
So it's not like you have to be able to bomb huge casts. You'd certainly cover more water with that, but that's by no means a prerequisite to approaching the Sound as a fishery. What I always tell people is if you're casting at 25 or 30 feet, all of the rest of that water beyond your fly, who gives a shit?
That's right.
Just cover the water that you can cover and don't worry about the rest of it. Yes, there's going to be fish that probably jump beyond you, beyond where your fly is.
Yeah.
And that should be your, you know, carrot in front of your nose to become a more proficient caster.
What's I'm coming from out of state and doing this, I mean, this is a basic question, but what's your recommended kind of rig, you know, like rod, weight, things like that, you know?
Yeah. 6 weight. Floating
nothing
line.
Nothing crazy. Okay.
Nope. Keep it simple.
Okay.
As a fly shop owner, let me caveat that. As a fly shop owner, you need a brand new high end 6 weight rod with salt water. Yeah, kidding. We get that all the time. And again, I want people to just get in the water and fish. If you've got a 5 weight, 5 weight's fine. Floating line, fine. You got a $40 reel, you're going to need to take really good care of it. Salt water always wins, but
right.
it can be done. Like, just go fish. Traffic in Seattle is one of the top five worst in the country. And, you know, in the shop, we hear this all the time that, well, you know, I just don't have the time to drive over to the Yakima and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, man, you live in West Seattle. We got four beaches within 15 minutes of us here.
Yeah, dude, it's cool.
Go hit it before it's, you know, in the summer, it's light at 4:30. Go fish for an hour or two, come back, have breakfast with your family, take your kids to school and go to work. That little tidbit of time, 2-3 times a week or 6-8 times a month is going to do so much for your mental health and happiness, as opposed to setting aside one singular day every 4 months to go fish and lumping all the onus of that, you know, happiness onto that one day and let it possibly just be a complete catastrophe or get canceled because of life, you know,
yeah,
form in one way or another.
Keep going. Sorry.
Those little inserts of time, you know, doing that help you learn, help you stay connected, keep the, you know, the passion of fly fishing, you know, flowing in you.
Yeah.
Connected to it.
It kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier in this idea that it's got to be Rocky Mountains and things like that. It keeps you connected. You know, if that's the water you have, fish the water you have. I mean, I want to make a t-shirt and, you know, like, fish the water you have.
That's a great t-shirt.
Because
that's exactly right.
I mean, if it takes traffic, you can't get to the Yakima, or, you know, like for me, I lived in Kansas City, Missouri, and I fished the Ozarks a little bit, but you know, that's a whole day of my life to go down there and fish. And, you know, when you got little kids, yeah, that's not really, it's not always the best. Right. So, but there's lakes and ponds around, fish that water, you know, and keep it going. What are some, if you could give, besides casting, are there any other techniques or other things, if you could only pass along two pieces of advice, somebody comes into the fly shop, they're going out, they're on their way. What are two common things or common techniques that you give people to help them catch fish?
These probably won't be what you were looking for, but I still feel like it doesn't happen frequently enough for people to get over those immediate hurdles that are presenting themselves to them. Ask questions.
That's good. Yeah.
Find a mentor and ask questions. Just don't be bashful about it. And in the search of your mentor, you're going to need to ask questions to find out who you can trust to be that mentor to you. And it doesn't have to be in a shop. It can be, or at least not a shop employee. It could be somebody that's checking out in front of you at the shop and asked a question that you wanted to ask. And then that gives you the gumption to ask another one. And then you end up in a conversation and then you two end up becoming friends, and one or both of you have something to offer the other that makes it a very symbiotic relationship to take to the water and help each other through these, you know, through that wrestling match of why am I not catching, or why are you and why am I not, stuff like that.
Okay. And that's good.
Ask questions. Don't be afraid to do it. The other would be, again, it's going to be kind of in line with the asking questions part, but be nimble and just try not to lock yourself into, and I know this is hard when you're starting out in the sport, try not to lock yourself into a singular train of thought that when something goes sideways, isn't how you thought it was going to be, that you don't have the flexibility to think outside that box you put yourself in. Even guides get in the same mindset where they're so repetitive on what they do that when something throws a knuckleball at them or a curveball at them, they just freeze up and they're like, and they lose that mobility to move laterally within the sport and try something new. Like early on, like if you're new to the sport, try everything. Try it all.
Do you remember a time on the sound that you, maybe a trip or a day or a fish that stands out in your mind as particularly memorable, where maybe you learned something or relearned something, or just was a special experience that made that fishery and what we're talking about unique and important to you?
There's a couple of them. I think the first one is when I decided that I was going to start to guide Puget Sound. And pretty much everybody that I talked to around here 20 years ago was like, or 25 years ago, they were like, you're an idiot. Nobody's ever going to want to be guided on Puget Sound. And the first trip that I guided and a guy caught a fish, I sat at home for the next week trying to read into the how, the why, the what that led us to catching that first fish on a guided trip. Even reading into all of that, I wasn't experienced enough to in that fishery to really glean that much from it. I look back at it now and I know what I would have like gleaned from it. Was this time
you kind of know why it happened? Yeah, a little more of the whys. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, but I just had to, you know, and that's kind of part of the beauty of the sport. Sometimes you're just not going to be able to answer your own questions with it. The only thing you can do is dig deep as you can with the experience that you have.
Yeah.
Glean what you can from that and try to store that away. Keep a journal. I tell people keep journals all the time so that they can keep track of commonalities in things, so that trends, as they start to see patterns emerge, they can at least use that as a baseline to start each time they go out. Not that they need to strictly adhere to that.
No, yeah, you get different.
The confidence to get there.
I agree. I started doing that, keeping a journal, and I've heard both sides of the coin on that. But for me, it does exactly what you said. It also, the way that my brain works, I like that. It's almost like, I don't know. I like keeping track of how many days I go to the river and what I learn not necessarily the number of fish that I catch, but just I can look and see like, okay, I see trends even while I'm writing out the journal entries. And
yeah, it helps a lot.
I think it's great. I've enjoyed it for me, but I know it's not for everybody. But I think it's cool. The other thing that you said that I thought was really important, glean what you can from that experience. And that sounds obvious, but I think it speaks to a deeper kind of, not controversy, but a different kind of opinion in fly fishing, which is like this idea that you have to earn it, or you have to be almost to the point where it's like you have to be worthy to have caught the fish. Like sometimes I think that mindset of earning it, or, you know, putting in your time, like that's all true. Like if you don't keep going, you won't catch more fish, or you won't progress and get better if you don't go. But at some point, everybody is catching that first fish for the first time. Like, you know what I mean? Did they earn that fish? What about the next one? And what about the next one? Like, where's that line, and who draws it, and who's the judge of that line? That is just something that it's always sat with me in a way that I don't understand. And I guess I comprehend the concept that if you're not being a steward of the resource and you're abusing it, I mean, I understand that. That's pretty understandable. But if people are just trying to learn, like even you as a guide who had been in Colorado, that first fish, you know, you're saying, I didn't even really understand at the time why I caught that fish. I understand it now. But I would argue that that doesn't make that experience any less special, right? I just asked you, what was one of the most special fish that you caught on the Sound? And you go back to the first one that you caught on a guided trip where you had the least amount of knowledge. So they're not one for one. It's not if this, then that. You know what I mean? You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's cool that you shared that story. I think that that is beneficial for a lot of people. So
I think it goes for me. I appreciate you saying that, Jason. For me, these days, and I think this comes with, again, age, and that is I want to I'm going to have, depending on what day you catch me, and if I, you know, if I've had a good day or a bad day, or if where we are or what question you ask or whatever, you might get some different, you know, semi-different facade to me, right? But at the end of the day, I always want to be vulnerable to the questions that are asked of me or from me. Mostly because I want people to feel like they're getting a true introspection of their, you know, from me, of their question that they asked. Because if they had the gumption to ask it, they deserve that.
For sure.
And I think showing the fact that, you know, that first fish with Arturo, who was from Spain and was a comic book artist in Spain, that trip 25 years ago is that memorable to me still. And I was vulnerable. I'm vulnerable in that situation because it wasn't my expertise that led us to that fish. That was just...
Right. But you took the leap. You still did the work to say, like, I'm going to fish the Puget Sound, even though nobody else thinks it's a good idea. I mean, that is important. You know, I mean, that you start down that road and then you built the experience when, you know, in the face of people saying, yeah, you're crazy to fish the Puget Sound. And now it's not as, you know, it's different, right? The other thing I want to say,
there were a couple of people that were doing it. I don't want to be given pioneer status on this, but I will say that almost everybody that I was close to at that point in time were like, you're
no, I don't mean it that way. I just mean like, it's hard to do things when the people around you are telling you that that's not a good idea.
It is. It's very difficult.
It's hard to make change in yourself and in your business and things. If you're not getting a lot of head nods, it's hard to believe in yourself and like keep going.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, our sport in particular has a hard time with that.
Sure. Yeah. Cause of all the opinions and.
It's that ego thing. And, you know, Instagram has really put this front out there of, you know, if I'm not showing the biggest fish, if I'm not showing this, then, you know, there's some people that don't give a crap and I applaud them for that. But there's definitely a far greater number that do than you'd probably like to think.
Yeah. It's the double-edged sword of fly fishing, I think, is that it can be so special to people, but at the same time, it's like this intoxicating ether that if you drink, then now that special experience is so special for you that now if somebody else is not doing that, like, well, you don't really understand because it's not really like my experience. Like people are not, it's hard for people. Not all people, some people. It can be hard for people, myself included, to get outside of their own personal, like, this is my world and I'm the most important part of that world. And, you know, we're all just fish swimming in water, right? You know, I mean, everybody's got to go where they got to go and do the other person stuck in traffic is just as upset as you are. But now.
Exactly.
The well, other person fly Jason. Fishing there, it's just as special as yours, man. You're not special.
Exactly. Well, you said it just a minute ago, the idea of who is it that decides where the line in the sand is on some of this stuff. Right. And that keeping up with the Joneses mentality just doesn't have to be in our sport.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't need to be the sport can be whatever it needs to be, or you want it to be to you. And no one else can hold judgment on that. If it's a solitary thing for you and you're wanting to hike 10 miles before you wet a line, perfect.
Cool.
If you won't fish because you're not with somebody else to share the experience, so be it. That just, you know, just means you got to find more people to fish with.
Yeah.
So, and everything in between, you know, and I totally agree with you. I think that's an important thing for people to kind of latch on to and keep close to them is that the sport just needs to be for you what you want it to be.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's really well said. The other thing I want to say before we kind of start wrapping things up is I think it says a lot about you that you've reached that point of, you said several times, vulnerable, right? And I've thought about this in my life, instructing in airplanes, humility, right? This idea. And I just think that's, I mean, just good for you, man, because there's so much credibility that can be gained from that perspective, whether you call it humility or vulnerability. But if you really want to be credible in something, you have to have that kind of like, yeah, I know what it's like to not know. I know what it's like to not catch fish. I know what it's like to start from zero. Or if you don't have that, people are just less likely to seek your advice, you know, because they want to talk to people like them. They want to relate to people, and they want to have that. And if you seek to instruct people, I think it's very important to have that perspective. So I don't know. I just want to commend you on like bringing that into your guide service, into your, the way that you fish and stuff. And I know a lot of people do, but I just think that I just want people to hear that, because I think it's important. I think that if you're not seeing that in somebody who is that mentor or that person that's supposed to be helping you, then maybe look for somebody else that is a little more, you know, relatable. No,
I totally agree with you. Thank you for that. Appreciate it, Jason.
Yeah, no worries. Before I ask my last question, Dave.
Yeah.
How can people find out more about you, your fly shop, and maybe schedule a guided trip? Or is there anything that you want to share that you're excited about coming up that people should know about?
I mean, we're pretty easy to find. Emerald Water Anglers, type it in. We should come up pretty quick. We've got maybe a confusing amount of Instagram handles for different facets of our business. But, you know, we've got the shop account and a travel account and a women's account. No, I just, my hope is that people that listen to this feel like, even if they don't know me, that if they have questions, they should feel comfortable reaching out to ask them.
I think they certainly do, man.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's not often that I say that in that fashion in a podcast or elsewhere, but I can't stress enough the idea that I possess considerable experience globally, and I'm more than happy to share it. And I don't necessarily feel as though a lot of that experience is something that I need to be billing you for. I want you to go find yourself in a place that just creates the memory of a lifetime, or sets you on a trajectory to change who you are. And if there's any way that I can possibly be that to you, man, reach out. I'm here. Super easy.
Well, we'll link to that in the show notes, and I'm sure that people will reach out and talk to you. And I've really enjoyed that. I could tell from my conversation with you that you are sincere in your statements. So, thank you for that, sir. Last question. You ready, Dave?
Yep.
If you could go back to when you first started fly fishing and give yourself two pieces of advice, one more tactical and one more philosophical, what would you tell yourself to help you progress as a fly fisher?
Okay. The tactical side first, I would say embrace the technology that was present when I was beginning at that time, which was fiberglass, and force myself to become a better caster with fiberglass, because it will without question help you become an extraordinary caster. If you can handle glass well, you're good. You're taken care of. So that's what I would have done different. I just kind of quickly tried to shrug glass off and get to graphite as fast as I could, because it was just more responsive to what I felt I needed to be. And again, being competitive and what I was at that age, glass felt old school, and I didn't want to be associated with it. It was very shallow, nearsighted, non-mentored view of what was present at that time in my life. So that's the first thing. Kind of philosophical there too. But the philosophical side, I would have not spent the night at friends' houses, so I didn't go fishing with my dad and my grandfather. I would have stayed home every night that I knew my dad was going to go fishing the next day. because you just don't get, you know, when you're young, you've got a life in front of you. And as you start to kind of wade through your life, you realize at some point you don't have that same existence of time and the luxury of it. And people start to get to a point where they can't just go back 30 or 40 years and share that moment with you anymore. They're physically incapable, or they pass on and they're no longer with you to share that moment. And hindsight and regret is a powerful motivation for changing how and who you are, if you allow it to. And so I would go back and spend more time with my family fishing and enjoying what it was back then.
Those are powerful answers, my friend. I appreciate those. I deal with that right now as well with my family, yeah, and my father and
yep.
And my son. You know, I'm trying to set the stage as well. We talked about that before, but yeah, I really appreciate those answers. Those are really thoughtful, as were all your answers today. So I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful for having you on the show, man. I really enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I wish you all the best out there. Thank you for being on the show.
Jason, it was a pleasure and an honor to be on this with you. Great to meet you in this fashion. And I sincerely hope you and I get to share FaceTime with each other on water or elsewhere sometime in the near future. It'd be fun just to get to know you better.
Thanks for listening to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. You can learn more about some of the topics we discussed in today's episode show notes. For more fly fishing ideas, stories, and artwork, check out my blog and online gallery at wadeoutthere.com. If you want to make Wade Out There a part of your own fly fishing journey, please subscribe and share. Until next time, Wade Out There.